called Numbers with Wings. Join me, and I will take you on a voyage through garage rock, punk, post-punk, cowpunk, Paisley Underground, and more, all viewed through my, some say, unique perspective. I will be broadcasting live on CFRC 101.9 FM, Sundays from 2 to 3 p.m., and on CFRC.ca a few seconds later, or you can check it out at your leisure.
Broadcasting 24/7, 365, you're listening to 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca, Kingston's only campus community radio station. Tune in for the best local programming.
Welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I am your host for this week's Grad Chat. A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs and CFRC, so a big thank you to both of them. If you miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either Google Podcasts, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. It's a great way to stay informed about all the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are working on these days. And today, I would like to introduce you to Iza Wahab, who is undertaking her master's in the Department of Biomedical and Molecular Sciences, or you may have heard DBMS, under the supervision of Dr. Myron Suchek. Welcome to Grad Chat, Iza.
Hi, Cam.
Thank you so much for coming today. And I want to ask to start, what made you want to stay at Queen's for graduate school after completing your undergraduate degree here?
Yeah, first of all, thank you so much for having me.
Of course.
I'm very happy to be here. With respect to your question, I did my undergrad at Queen's in health sciences, and I really liked health sciences and the faculty. I met Dr. Suchek through my best friend, Rochelle. She also did a grad chat here.
Oh, very nice.
And I thought Dr. Suchek was just the most eccentric, fun, and kind soul. So I really wanted to work with him. I remember my best friend would come home and she'd be like, Dr. Suchek just shared his soup and his sandwich with me today. It was so lovely. His wife made it. And I just thought I would love to work with someone who is so dedicated to the field, but also a compassionate person outside of work. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a huge factor, right? Making sure you choose the right graduate supervisor.
Exactly.
And it sounds like it's a very nice fit for you so far.
Love the sandwiches.
And so for your research, you are working on your project. Estrone uses a biased GPCR signaling paradigm to modulate cancer progression. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about what that looks like and what your project looks like on a day-to-day basis?
Of course, yeah. So there are three main forms of estrogen. Mm-hmm. There's E1, E2, and E3. So that's estrone, estradiol, and estriol.
Okay.
A lot of the research and the knowledge that circulates through the media is about estradiol, so E2, as opposed to E1 or E3.
Okay.
And this is because E2 dominates puberty to menopause. Mm. So for the vast majority of your life, E2 is the dominant hormone, or estrogen, I should say. But after menopause, E1 dominates. Mm. And a lot of the research doesn't focus on E1 because it has a lower binding affinity relative to E2. And so people think, you know, we're binding to the same receptors. Shouldn't we focus on the one that binds stronger and dominates over a longer period of our time?
Mm-hmm.
But after menopause, the E1 levels circulate even up to 100 times more than E2.
Okay, wow.
So it's important to look at something, even though it may not bind as strongly, we see a lot of it. And there's hardly as much E2 at all after menopause. So that's why I wanted to look more so into E1 as opposed to E2. And what I'm actually doing with E1 is I want to look at a specific signaling pathway, and that's where the GPCR comes in. So GPCR stands for G protein coupled receptor.
Okay.
And the goal here is to see if E1 can employ a specific GPCR that we look at in the lab called NMBR, if that can interact with, so E1 has its GPCR called GPER, mm-hmm. and we want to see if this interacts with a GPCR that we've been focusing on in the lab called NMBR. And then this will activate a downstream pathway, which will ultimately affect cancer progression. You can either increase or decrease cancer progression.
Okay, so mm-hmm. it sounds very integral to understanding women's cancers then.
Exactly. Okay. Very much so.
Very nice. So you mentioned that E2 is kind of has been the main focus of a lot of mm-hmm. Literature so far. So, and you're switching to E1 instead. So mm-hmm. what is the importance of your research if E1 uses this pathway that you've described to either increase or decrease cancer progression?
Yeah, so the implications of this for women after menopause, let's say that I have determined that E1 uses this pathway mm-hmm. to increase cancer.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Then we might want to target this pathway to prevent cancer from exacerbating.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say E1 uses this pathway to decrease cancer. Then we might want to look into supplementing E1, and then maybe that would help women prevent cancer or help treat cancer. Those are definitely down the line, but this would be the formative research to get us to that place down the line.
Oh, very exciting. So it sounds like it's your research could have some very potential clinical mm-hmm. impacts or interventions in the future.
Fingers crossed.
Fingers yeah. crossed, yes, of
Maybe
course.
20 years, but yes. you know, we'll get there, hopefully.
But of course, research, right? We all, mm-hmm. Research contributes piece by piece, and everything that's built mm-hmm. on allows, you know, the next generation of researchers and clinicians to then develop from
exactly.
there. So hopefully, oh, that's mm-hmm. very exciting, though. So do the levels of E1 have different effects? Because you mentioned that they fluctuate over mm-hmm. over a woman's lifetime. So do these levels, do they impact women differently? And is a high level a good thing, a low level a good thing? What are the different impacts that, you know, different levels could have on mm-hmm. a woman?
Yeah, of course. This is something that has been very tumultuous in
okay.
my research.
Mm-hmm.
I initially started my research using super physiological concentrations of E1, which just means above normal physiological levels.
Okay.
And I found that E1 prevented cancer progression for the most part through different experiments that I had
okay.
done.
Okay, so if someone had an elevated level, mm-hmm. you're working with elevated levels.
Exactly.
And, okay.
Yeah. And so that contrasted with previous literature that I had come across.
Mm.
And I was wondering, you know, I'm using E1, I'm using the same cell lines, I'm using the same experimental methodology. Why am I seeing contradictory results? So my mm-hmm. results are showing that, you know, the cancer cells aren't migrating, they aren't getting worse. But the literature is saying that it is making it worse, and it's making it more so, the cancer cells are moving to a greater extent in my E1 treated cells rather than E2. So what's the cause for this discrepancy? Why mm-hmm. am I seeing different results? And so that's where I had different ideas. I was thinking, you know, maybe E1 is being converted to E2 by enzymes, because that can happen sometimes. Mm. Or, you know, maybe that could be one. But the reason why I was able to say that, rule that out, was because I had used E2 before, mm-hmm. and I saw similar lack of migration of my cancer cells.
Hmm.
So it wasn't the E1 turning into E2. And then I also looked at the cell types. I had used a variety of cell types. I used pancreatic cancer cells. I used breast cancer cell types. I was still seeing this discrepancy. It wasn't making sense. And then I finally came to the conclusion that it's the concentrations.
Okay.
The concentrations that I'm using, because they're so high, I'm seeing different results. And, you know, it might be that the receptor is getting desensitized, because I mentioned that pathway mm-hmm. involving the G protein coupled receptors. Maybe because the concentrations are so high, we're seeing that receptor not functioning as it normally would.
Mm.
So maybe we're seeing dose dependent effects. And so I've tried to go back to the drawing board and start things from scratch and work with a broader range of concentrations. So from zero to normal physiological mm-hmm. levels to slightly above normal physiological levels. And I want to, you know, rerun those experiments, make sure that what I'm seeing is actually true results.
Oh, that's very exciting then, right? That you're, and I think a very clear part of the research process, right? You're mm-hmm. seeing these, you're testing your hypothesis, you're getting these strange results that contradict the literature that you're mm-hmm. reading, you're brainstorming, and then you're back to the drawing board with a new experimental design,
yeah.
which you're now undertaking. So
mm-hmm.
it's kind of nice to see that it's research in progress.
Mm-hmm.
So what makes, you mentioned that it might be the high concentration of E1 might be kind of disrupting some of the signaling that's going mm-hmm. on. So why are you investigating this specific pathway, the GPCR that you mentioned, and not maybe other pathways that are happening as E1 is traveling through your different cell types?
Yeah. So a major reason why I chose to do this is because I wanted to look into MB231 cancer cells. And so that is a triple negative breast cancer cell line.
And that would be, for our listeners, that would be like an aggressive form of cancer?
Yeah.
Yes, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's different receptors that, mm-hmm. that cancers have. And with triple negative breast cancer, we can't work with those receptors mm. like we normally would. And that's what makes it so aggressive. We can't target what we normally would have been able to mm-hmm. with another breast cancer cell line. And so if we can't target those normal pathways, I wanted to look into this new pathway that should be found in all cells. And my research has shown it is present in these triple negative breast cancer cell lines. And it, let's say it does promote cancer down the line, I can target this pathway to help women with these particularly aggressive cancers,
mm.
potentially.
Hopefully, yes.
Yeah,
no, in a new
crossed.
Way, though. That's very exciting, right? The potential there mm-hmm. for you to find a new avenue for maybe future, again, this is all down the line, mm-hmm. but to contribute to the development of like different drug delivery pathways mm-hmm. or different interventions that could decrease the spread or the intensity mm-hmm. of different cancers traveling. Mm-hmm. So where and how does your research fit into the overall direction of Dr. Suchik's lab? It sounds like you mentioned your friend had done research mm-hmm. and that kind of inspired you to get involved in the first place. But where does your research fit within where Dr. Suchik's lab is exploring right now?
Yeah, of course. So Dr. Suchik is particularly interested in the signaling pathway. Mm. And what we do at our lab is different individuals have different compounds that they use to see how it interacts with this pathway. So for example, my best friend who was investigating cannabinoids, people are also looking into fentanyl, mm. hydromorphone, all those kinds of things to see how it affects this pathway. And historically, we have looked at this pathway with pancreatic cancer and mm. showed promising results. And that's taking, hopefully, fingers crossed, clinical trials are going to be successful with that. But this pathway is the focus of Dr. Suchik's lab and just experimenting with different things, seeing how they interact with different types of cancer, different types of compounds, all that stuff.
Oh, very, very interesting. And mm-hmm. you kind of alluded to this a little bit already, but what impact do you think your research, your colleagues' research, and you know the general research of Dr. Suchik's lab could have for men and women with cancer in general? Like, what are some of the potential impacts that you see coming out of the lab?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so with respect to the pancreatic cancer, well, so we have this pathway. Mm-hmm. And if you target specific parts of this pathway, you can prevent cancer progression downstream. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we found with different compounds. So for example, we found that if we inhibited this specific part of the pathway, we would prevent cancer progression in pancreatic cancer. And that applies to different compounds mm-hmm. that we're using. So let's say cannabinoids increase cancer using this pathway. Then maybe we want to look into stopping this pathway, potentially decreasing the use of cannabinoids. Mm-hmm. Those are downstream applications depending on the results that we find after working with this pathway. It depends on the results that we see with mm-hmm. each compound, but with each compound, we can either go take it in two directions. Either it promotes cancer, prevents cancer, or has no effect. Depending on the knowledge that we acquire, we can use that and see how we're going to use that clinically down the line, potentially.
So it sounds like a lot of many different avenues mm-hmm. for increasing our knowledge around cancer and how different types of cancers and how they operate mm-hmm. and ways we can either make clinical interventions or lifestyle interventions mm-hmm. to try and kind of decrease cancer growth and progression mm-hmm. in the future. That sounds like the main goal, which
yeah,
sounds like
it all depends on what we find.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Either way, we're either going to find that cancer is being exacerbated or it's not. It potentially is getting improved or there's no effect. Mm-hmm. But depending on the results that we find, we can encourage those lifestyle alterations or potentially clinical interventions down the line.
Oh, so it sounds like very promising work and very exciting work because I know I think many people have experience with cancer, whether in their own lives and the mm-hmm. lives of their friends and family, and it's something mm-hmm. that touches a lot of people in different ways. So I think your research contributing to our understanding of that and you know the development of better interventions and treatments, I'm sure, is much appreciated by many, many people in Canada. And it sounds like you stay quite busy in the lab then with all of this going on. It sounds like there's a lot of work to be done.
Mm-hmm. More or less, yeah. We definitely have fun.
No, that's good.
We definitely have fun. Dr. Shuchuk can attest to that. We have a lot of fun in the lab.
Well, it sounds like it's a great place to be and really be doing, conducting some research. Mm-hmm. So you're working within this triple negative breast cancer cell line, mm-hmm. and you're investigating a pathway where E1 is moving, like where E1 is moving through. How do you know that that's the pathway that you're actually investigating and it's not, you know, moving somewhere else through the cell? How do you confirm that in your research?
Of course. So the mere fact that I'm using those triple negative breast cancer cell lines is to more definitively isolate the effects that I'm seeing to this pathway. So I originally had to use pancreatic cell lines and other breast cancer cell lines that have those different receptors. So estrogen can bind to different receptors, but by using triple negative breast cancer cell lines, they lack those receptors. I had mentioned earlier, that's why it's such an aggressive cancer, because it doesn't have those typical means to exert effects or to target. So by using those triple negative breast cancer cell lines, I can isolate the effects that I'm seeing to my pathway more so than if it had other receptors to use. It just doesn't have those receptors. So I know, or have a greater inclination, that it is using this pathway. Mm. It just doesn't have another route.
Yes. So that's helpful for both knowing the impact that E1 is having, and then also for I guess your methodology, it makes sense as well, right? To use this like in both the type of cell you're using and then both to the measurements you're trying to take. It allows you to do both really well.
Yeah. And I'll consolidate that with further experiments, of course, but using that cell line to begin with is a good starting spot.
Okay. But in addition to all of this work that you're doing, I hear that you also have a pretty wide variety of hobbies that keep you busy outside of the lab. Yeah. Could you tell us a little bit about your forays into pottery to start with?
Yeah, so I do pottery in this lovely lady's basement, Linda. Free promo for Linda. She's wonderful. And I've been doing pottery with her since the entirety of my undergrad, so it's been around like 5 years.
Wow.
For a really long time, I just did hand building, so sculpting. Mm-hmm. I made things like skulls, like figurines, sculptures, stuff like that. But now I've been working with a wheel.
Okay.
And those skills are not translatable in the slightest. I'm really struggling with it, but
the wheel is hard, right? Getting centered on the wheel is incredibly hard. I've dabbled, but it is so hard to do.
It really is. Yes. And then every time you think you've got it, something goes wrong and you're like, oh my goodness, I just spent 30 minutes trying to center this pot and it just flew off the wheel, you know? But it is so fun experimenting with little things. And it, you know, something from the lab is you learn patience. You have to, you learn and you try again and you learn and you try again. It's iterative. And I find that I do that a lot in pottery as well. Just, I mess up, I learn, and then I try again.
Try again, yes. Yeah. That same approach to research design on the wheel. Uh-huh. And what have you made anything in particular on the wheel? Have you had any success with it so far?
Yeah, I'm working with little bowls now.
Lovely.
And I'm having a lot of fun working with the glazes. I used to be a little bit conservative with my glazing. I didn't experiment too much, but now I've been, you know, trying to mix colors, and it's been really fun.
What, have you come up with any color combos that you're particularly proud of?
Yeah. What's really interesting about glazing is, I'm sure you might know, you dip it in red and it becomes black, you know? It changes because the temperature of the kiln is so high. And I've really like this cat's eye sort of thing that I'm making. So it's the bowl itself, I would dip it in potentially green and then black on the rim or something, and it would look like almost like a cat's eye or something.
Oh, very cool.
So
yeah.
I'm having a lot of fun with that.
Yes, and that's also, again, the lessons of research and design coming through a lot in pottery.
Of course.
And I wonder, too, depending on what your background in undergrad was, I know you said you were in health sciences, so I know that can mean a variety of things, but if you ever have to touch on any chemistry background for your glazing, thinking about back to high school chemistry, or I don't know if you took chemistry in undergrad think about what type of reactions you could expect. But then so many variables, so you can't really...
I know nothing.
It's both an art and a science, right?
Yeah, of course. I focus on the art part.
Yes.
Well, at least when it comes to pottery.
Yes, the fun part, yes. Yeah. So. And I hear that you have some other artistic outlets as well beyond pottery. So could you tell me about some of the other things that you get up to creatively?
Yeah, I do also in another wonderful lady's basement, I do some painting and sketching. So far, I've been trying to recreate some really famous pieces of art. So the KISS has been a painting. I think his name is Gustav Klimt.
Yes, that sounds familiar. Yes,
it, right. Mm-hmm. It's a very famous painting by him, and it's always spoken to me. I always thought it was so beautiful. So I repainted that. I had my own kind of artistic flair. And I've been working with gold foil as well, just implementing into that the painting.
Did you do the full scale of the KISS? No, because I know it's quite a gigantic painting.
No, definitely not. It's probably a little bit bigger than the average paper. And right now I'm doing, I think it's The Lady with the Parasol or The Woman with the Parasol by Monet.
Okay,
so
very
that's,
nice.
That's the latest.
That's one. And did you, are these different teachers that you find, are they from the local Kingston community?
Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
Okay.
They're wonderful. I grew up in Kingston, actually.
Oh, nice.
So I've had these connections, or I've been familiar with people. So I work with Chinbo for art, Chinbo School of Art, another promo. And so I did art classes with her in high school, and then things got a little bit busy, and I discontinued, and then I decided, you know, there's some things that you need to make time for, despite how busy your lab is or despite whatever you're busy with. And so I was like, I really want to get started again. And she welcomed me with open arms, and here we are.
Oh, that's lovely. No, it's nice to have balance, right?
Yeah,
those things
course.
Help. And I do think, like you have said, there's a lot of crossover in some of the kind of the lessons that you learn from research that you apply to other things, especially art, which is so, like you said, iterative, but it's always an experiment. So it's nice that you see this kind of crossover. And I'm sure working in the background of your subconscious when you're enjoying painting or pottery, your mind is working on those problems. Like, why won't my experiment show me what I was expecting?
Yeah, and then you just go back to the drawing board because you really think that something is going to be one way.
Mm-hmm.
It never is.
No.
You know, and then you have to just start all over again.
And yes, I would say those apply equally to art and to research,
yeah,
right?
Of
yes.
Course.
So that is, it's nice that you're able to keep those passions going. And I also hear that you have a special type of cruise planned for this summer. Where are you planning to travel, and what are you going to be up to on this trip?
Yeah, so the cruise that actually happened, it was a one-day kind of expedition, what it's called, All the Rage Sport Fishing.
Okay.
It's chartered fishing, and the person who, I think his name is Mike, he's actually a professor at Queen's.
Oh, very cool.
I think he is in, I think he works with physio.
Okay.
His research seemed to be related to cardiac health and something along those lines. Forgive me, Mike, if I'm butchering your research. Dr. Mike, I should say. But we set out to Lake Ontario. We just went into the middle of the lake, and you know, all you could see was water. And you know, I don't know if you've watched like Life of Pi or anything like that, where you're it just seems so fictional. You're like, oh my goodness, like what might that feel like, that kind of, you're just, it's just you. There's nothing else. It's just you. But it was a relaxing feeling. It didn't cause me any panic. And we unfortunately didn't catch any fish. But it was really relaxing. I took a nap in the sun. You know, it was an interesting experience. And he said, you know, it's such a wonderful experience to catch, you know, a big lake trout. So he's like, you have to come again. And, you know, it's on the house because we didn't catch anything the first time.
Oh, that's lovely. So will you go back again this summer, do you think?
Fingers crossed, June or July, we'll be back.
And are you an avid fisher person?
I am.
Okay.
I love fishing. My dad and I go fishing all the time. There's a lot of bass and pike in Kingston and the surrounding areas. So we always go fishing around this time.
And I guess what would be your largest catch or your favorite catch of all time?
Yeah, I was just thinking about that. You know, there was this one time I was fishing and I had got this bass, and the bass wasn't too big, but as I was reeling it in, there's a bigger pike going in to eat the bass, and so I'd reeled it in and I ended up only catching the bass because the pike hadn't, you know, securely eaten the bass. And my dad was like, oh my goodness, why'd you do that? Like, why didn't you get the pike too? And I was like, you know, I did my best. There's only so much you can do. You can't.
Trying to get a double catch.
Exactly.
That's,
you know,
pretty incredible.
I got a single catch, you know, hopefully that would, I mean, it fed us, so we're good. Yeah.
Oh, that's, well, it sounds like you've got some fun plans and that you've also, I know you've been trying some Brazilian jiu-jitsu out. You are a person of all trades.
Like, I tried jiu-jitsu, but everything hurt. I go to jiu-jitsu and I'd come back and I'd be bruised and I'd be like, my head hurts, my fingers hurt, like everything hurts. So I've discovered I'm more of a lover and not so much of a fighter. I think I might try something maybe a little bit less prone to concussions, something that would make me less prone to concussions. So I think I might try maybe, I think it was another type of martial arts. So
try something else.
I went to a dip fest where people bring things to dip and things to dip in. And one of the ladies there, she was like, you know, you got to try this type of martial arts. So I'm trying to remember what it is, but once I remember, I'll know for sure.
Reach out to her. Yeah. Yes. No, no.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you are not afraid to try anything, it sounds like.
I try to try everything at least once. And I like most things. And even if you don't like it, at least you know now that you don't like it.
And do you coerce any of your lab mates into joining you on some of these different activities? Or
I mean, if they're not too busy, the lab gets busy. But Rochelle, my best friend again, she encouraged me to try jiu-jitsu, so I tried it because she had so much fun with it. Again, I think she's a little bit more resilient than I am because she's decided to continue. But yeah, we do a little bit of that stuff together.
And what type of advice would you give to other master's or PhD students on campus who are maybe new to Kingston and are looking for fun things to do? What advice would you give to them to find out about these different types of activities?
Yeah, so I find that a lot of people say, oh, I've always wanted to try pottery when I tell them I've done pottery, or, you know, I really like fishing, but it seems to be just a wish and not something they follow through with. And so I think if you're interested in anything and you're a little bit nervous, you're like, this is new, I don't know how to do this, go online, ask your friends, you know, really make the most of your time here because you only have so much time, and Kingston is a beautiful place. It's not boring by any means. You have to make the most of what you're given. And I think that if you want to try something, go for it, search for it, ask people, you will find it.
Yeah, you'll find someone who's willing to take you out on their boat, or take you to their studio, or take you somewhere.
Exactly.
Yes, no.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you balance all of your responsibilities and activities? Do you have any advice for folks who are thinking, oh my goodness, I'm so busy in the lab, but all these extracurriculars sound lovely. How do you balance all of those?
I say you have to dedicate. I used to be so busy in undergrad, I'd say, I need to have Fridays off. That's the one day I need to have completely to myself. And I think that if you're able to afford that in the lab, or even maybe not an entire day, sometimes that's not reasonable or feasible, saying, you know, after 5 p.m., after I leave the lab, I need to have Mondays to myself, and I need to dedicate that to pottery. Even if you don't have a teacher, maybe you can buy your own wheel, and maybe you can try it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's on your own time. It offers you more flexibility that way. But just making sure you dedicate a specific day or time to yourself and making the most of it.
Yeah, so carving out some time. Mm-hmm. As it sounds like, are you good at scheduling then? Like scheduling yourself and all of your activities?
Yes. That's for sure, yeah.
Yeah. No, it's challenging, right? But it's important because I do think when you are able to enjoy your life outside of research, that it also brings more joy into your research as well. But I know there's seasons of research where you have to be in the lab at all times, depending on what type of, you know, if you're working with an animal model or a cell model, you might need to attend to those beings quite a bit.
Yeah.
But when you've left for the day to make sure you build in some time for self-care or whatever activity recharges you.
Yeah.
Well, it has been so lovely speaking with you. Thank you so much for coming in, Izza. Good luck with the rest of your research, and I can't wait to see where your topic takes you and where your work may end up down the line in a few decades as well.
I'll keep you updated. Thank you so much, KM, for having me. I've had such a wonderful time.
Oh, thank you.
This has been such an amazing opportunity. Another thing for grad students, do come here. This is amazing.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you for the shameless promotion. We would love to feature all grad students and postdocs across campus.
Yeah.
We love to learn about what you're working on, and we want to share your work with our broader community. So if you are ever interested, please reach out. You can find, if you search Grad Chat on the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs website, you can find our page and how to join us. And we would love to learn more about what you are up to. So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just search Grad Chat. Until next week, this is KM on the FM.
Broadcasting 24/7, 365. You're listening to 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca, Kingston's only campus community radio station. Tune in for the best local programming.
Today on Wings, the fourth and so far the final UN World Conference on Women took place in China, August 30th through September 11th, 1995. China tried to forbid reporting from the non-governmental part of the event, which they located in a half-built town called Huairu, far from Beijing. Community radio women defied their rule. Here's some of what we reported.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world. Produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. Today's newscast covers the Fourth World Conference on Women in Beijing and its associated non-governmental forum in Huairou, China. Here's more. About 15,000 women from around the world filled a stadium in Beijing August 30th for the opening of the NGO Forum, meaning Non-Governmental Organization Forum, of the Fourth World Conference on Women. China's first all-woman symphony orchestra, organized for the occasion, played works of Western and Chinese composers. There were vast displays of precision dancing by Chinese women and children. A blimp carried the conference keywords, equality, development, and peace. And of course there were speeches. The Venerable Helvi Sipilä of Finland, who had chaired the first World Conference on Women 20 years ago, discussed women's progress toward their goals.
We have made some quite outstanding steps forward in the field of equality. We have also started to understand that women are very important citizens in all our efforts for the development of the society. But, my dear friends, what have we women done for peace? To my mind, absolutely nothing, as we can see in our present world affairs. Women are still only objects and not subjects. My dear friends and sisters, how long can we tolerate this situation?
Peace was one of the many topics of workshops, panels, and demonstrations during the 10-day NGO Forum, and a peace tent hosted discussions between women of warring nations. Overall, more than 30,000 people attended more than 1,000 activities, which filled most of the major public buildings in the Beijing suburb of Huairou, plus scores of booths, tents, and outdoor stages. Logistics were hampered by unseasonal rain, which moved U.S. First Lady Hillary Clinton's speech into a 1,500-seat auditorium, from which thousands were turned away.
This conference is about making sure that women, their children, their families have the opportunities for health care and education, for jobs and political participation, for lives free of violence, for basic legal protections, and yes, for internationally recognized human rights, no matter who they are or where they live. But when one looks at the progress that has been made throughout the world, it is clear that it is the NGOs who have charted real advances for women and children. It is the NGOs who have pressured governments and have led governments down the path to economic, social, and political progress, often in the face of overwhelming hostility, and you will be the key players in determining whether or not this conference goes beyond rhetoric and actually does something to improve the lives of women and families.
NGO forum participants, being non-governmental, were free to discuss and act on subjects diplomats at the official conference couldn't touch. For example, when the French detonated the first of a series of massive nuclear tests in the Pacific, there were spontaneous calls to boycott French products. Kamla Basin of India chaired a panel on globalization of the economy, where she taught the audience this song.
Pepsi Cola, Coca Cola, kisam kisam ka cola. Pepsi Cola, Coca Cola, kisam kisam ka cola. Par peene ka pani gayab jab bhi nal ka khola, kaisi niti hai. It says there is Pepsi Cola, there is Coca Cola, all kinds of cola. But there's no water when I open the tap.
A youth talent night included young women from Western Sahara, whose song denounced the occupation of their country by Morocco. The number and variety of events at the conference far exceeded what was humanly possible to absorb. Many women said their favorite moments were personal conversations on the bus, or simply looking at the huge variety of women of different races, dress, and culture, who shared many of the same feminist principles.
I've been feeling something like what a drop of rain must feel when she falls into the sea, where she suddenly feels so big, so strong, so powerful, part of a vastness which connects from one continent to another.
For the Women's International News Gathering Service, I'm Frieda Worden.
Gonna keep on.
Australian mainstream media gave the UN conference and NGO forum in Beijing a low profile. The main issues discussed at the forum have been all but ignored, as Kath McGinty, Executive Director of the International Women's Development Agency, outlined. I asked Kath what her main criticisms of the media's coverage are.
My primary criticism, Karen, is that the focus of the media is on the easy stories, and the easy stories are not what the conference is all about. By the easy stories, I refer to things like the visa problems women have had in getting into China, the Chinese surveillance and harassment of women, which we need to know about, but it is distracting from what the conference is all about. Or even worse, some journalists are deliberately, it seems, trying to trivialise the conference by focusing on extremely obscure workshops at the forum or on film stars or personalities who happen to be attending. Now, these are all what the conference is not about. What the conference is about is thousands of women and men who have engaged in international dialogue over the past 2 to 3 years on a series of very complex issues related to women. And the product of their work is the draft platform for action, and which is the basis for negotiations at the Beijing conference. And this document, the platform for action, is going to be the blueprint used by governments all around the world for the advancement of women as we go into the 21st century. And this, to me, is what the real issues are about. The platform for action covers 12 critical areas of concern that women have listed as their prime areas that they need addressing. And these are the areas that I think the media should be addressing and reporting on, the sorts of debates and the level of debate and the arguments all around each of these issues that are going on at the conference at the moment. I'll just quickly list the 12 critical areas of concern so that listeners know what I'm talking about. They're to do with the increasing burden of poverty on women, on education, health, violence against women, the effects of armed struggle on women, women's access to and participation in the definition of economic structures and policies and the whole productive process itself, the sharing of power and decision-making at all levels, about the mechanisms to promote the advancement of women generally, women's human rights, and interestingly, the 10th critical area of concern is the role that the media plays in promoting women's positive contribution to society. It's seen as basically not doing that, and the general portrayal of women is not good enough. The other two areas of concern are to do with women's role in contributing to managing natural resources and safeguarding the environment, and the final one is the persistent discrimination and violation of the rights of the girl child. Now, I see these as the real issues, what the conference is all about, and I feel that the media should be covering these in depth for the public.
You mentioned that you thought the media was basically dealing with what you called easy issues. Do you think they are capable of in-depth analysis of this broad range of issues that has been identified as part of it being developed for the draft platform?
Well, I'd hate to think that our Australian journalists are morons, and I refuse to give in to that. A lot of them don't seem to be taking the effort to educate themselves, which is very sad, and as a consequence, they're not educating the Australian public. A lot of the letters that I've been reading lately, letters to the editor in various newspapers, are quite disturbing. One quote that seems to be coming up in quite a few letters to the editor is that this conference has little bearing on the real needs of most women around the world, unquote. To me, this just demonstrates the gross ignorance that people have about the conference, because how can we expect the general public, who are the ones who read the paper and listen to the stories, to know what it's about if the journalists aren't presenting it properly and as it is? There's one of the critical areas of concern that I mentioned earlier was the media. And I think that the way the Australian media has generally, I do speak generally, there are exceptions, of course, but the way that Australian media generally is reporting the conference is really a strong indicator as to why the media has been included as the 10th critical area of concern. There was a report released in Sydney, I think it was this morning, and also in Beijing simultaneously, saying that of all people interviewed by the media in Australia, only one in five are women. The other interesting thing that this report comes up with is that the issues that women are saying worldwide that they are most interested in are to do with sexual harassment, with violence, with childcare and health. However, they found that those issues are covered in only 10% of Australian news stories. So I think this is sort of a pretty good indicator that journalists generally need to get off their butts and do something about the real issues that concern women and what women are interested in and want to hear.
Kath McGinty, Executive Director of the International Women's Development Agency, talking with Karen James of Australia's Women on the Line.
On Wings, these are community radio producers' reports from the Fourth World Conference on Women held in China in 1995. The same issues are still active today.
I'm very pleased to hear that the World Bank is changing now, but I'm coming from Africa where women and children are becoming poorer, and we believe that one of the reasons is because of the structural adjustment which has hit very hard on the women. We are all mortgaged.
During the Fourth World Conference on Women, many non-governmental organizations voiced strong criticisms of the World Bank. When the bank lends money to developing countries, it requires changes or structural adjustment to economic and social policies. Ming Chau Nguyen, a Vietnamese economist, spoke for the World Bank on a panel at the non-governmental forum. Nguyen has worked for the bank for 20 years and is the new manager of the Gender Analysis and Policy Group, a subset of the Poverty and Social Policy Department. Ming Chao Nguyen.
In terms of policy lending, the bank is of course known for structure adjustment programs. But we do much more than just privatizations of fiscal balance. We are beginning to integrate gender concerns in these structure adjustment programs. For example, in Honduras, we have put on the economic reform agenda the land reform policy that would ensure the right for women to own land. In Pakistan, the adjustment effort call for a shift of government expenditure toward primary levels where a lot of women and girls benefit, and within this shift of resource, there be targeting at girls. Let me just put the record straight here. In 334 structure adjustment programs that the World Bank has made since 1980, the World Bank has never made a loan conditional on the government cutting on health and education budgets. On the contrary, 60% of the loan made on the recommendation to government to maintain or increase the level, and 40% made the loan conditional on the government maintaining or increasing social expenditure. There is a big difference between what is in the structure adjustment program and what is going on with the implementation by the government.
Nguyen said that the policies of the World Bank have evolved to reflect an awareness of women's contributions to the development of nations.
It is now accepted that investing in women is good economics. It is not a soft issue, it is a hard-nosed economic fact. And we need this to convince the ministers of finance and the ministers of plan whom we work with closely. Our study has also shown that not only there is a trade-off between growth and inequality, but the inefficiencies that are caused by gender inequality can also hamper growth. Growth is not an end in itself, we said. The quality and sustainability of growth matters. Therefore, investing in women ensures the quality and sustainability of this growth, as it affects the welfare of the future generations and the environment they live in.
After Nguyen finished speaking, women in the audience used the question and answer session to challenge her assertion that the World Bank is concerned with the health and well-being of women.
I'm Niloufar Ahmad from Bangladesh. My question is to Ms. Ming Chao Nguyen. Before the World Bank started the structural adjustment program, they haven't done a feasibility study on the gender impact. But since we have seen over the decade that it has terrible impact on women and environment, I'd like to know now that whether the people who have lost their livelihood and the environment which is destroyed can get compensation from the World Bank for their losses.
For Wings, I'm Laura Saponara.
Lesbian organizations attending the Fourth World Conference on Women in Huaidou, China, had ongoing activities in the lesbian tent. The tent was a safe, supportive space for lesbians attending the conference, and Chinese participants from volunteers to officials were attracted to the tent out of curiosity. Before the conference began, there were rumors circulating that the conference would consist of lesbians and prostitutes who would streak naked down the streets and that officials were planning to throw blankets over them. While no blankets were thrown, the lesbian tent did experience a small amount of harassment. Rachel Rosenblum of the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission explained.
The level of harassment of this tent has been literature being confiscated yesterday, only the Chinese language literature being confiscated, as well as photographs being taken of people in this tent from neighboring tents.
During a press conference at the tent, Palisa Beverly Didsey, a lesbian activist from South Africa, revealed what was in the confiscated literature.
It was a brochure of the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission on just basic human rights demands by lesbians.
Daily at 5 p.m., there was a briefing at the lesbian tent about the progress of government delegations who are working on the official platform for action in Beijing. Because the term sexual orientation was controversial, it had been placed in brackets, meaning it was still under debate. Michelle Cove and Rachel Rosenblum were among the women reporting.
For about a year and a half, we've been organizing and trying to get lesbian rights into this paper called the Platform for Action. We've been marginally successful. We have sexual orientation or sexual choice mentioned in brackets. So we're looking forward to unbracket this language that we fought so hard for.
In the final document, sexual orientation was eliminated from the mission statement and from sections on legal discrimination, employment discrimination, and human rights. Support for the wording had grown, however.
This is the first time that sexual orientation will be discussed at this level at the UN conference. It has been mentioned before in other UN documents, and it has been articulated very positively. Just last year, the Human Rights Commission ruled that the Tasmanian anti-gay law violated the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which was a very major position for a UN agency to make about the right to privacy and the freedom from discrimination based on sexual orientation. So it is not the first time the UN has dealt with this, but it is the first time that all the governments of the world will be debating the issue in Beijing at this level of an international conference.
In 1993, at the World Conference on Human Rights, only the Netherlands spoke for including sexual orientation. At the Women's Conference, more than 30 countries supported it, including South Africa, Jamaica, Barbados, Canada, the U.S., Cuba, Brazil, Slovenia, Colombia, Australia, New Zealand, Israel, and countries of the European Union. The countries hotly debating the language were Libya, Sudan, Uganda, Syria, and the Vatican, or so-called Holy See. In the final document, the mission statement reads, quote, many women face particular barriers because of such factors as their race, age, language, ethnicity, culture, religion, disability, or other status, or because they are indigenous people. According to the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, some countries went on record saying that the other status included sexual orientation. In the final document, under Women in Health, paragraph 97 now states, quote, the human rights of women include their right to have control over and decide freely and responsibly on matters related to their sexuality, including sexual and reproductive health, free of coercion, discrimination, and violence. Reporting for Wings, this is Lisa Hayes.
Julie Drizin of Pacifica caught another aspect of the conference in her story on the disabled women at the NGO Forum.
No braille, no tape for the blind. There are no ramps. This ramp is broken. This woman in the wheelchair just very almost tipped over, not even 5 minutes ago. No one cares. Women must understand that disabled women are women too. We are part of the women's community. Please talk to your sisters from around the world who are here. Please understand that we are women. We are women. We are women. We are women. We are women.
1 year ago, disability rights activists wrote to conference organizers to explain their specific needs in order to fully participate in this historic event. But the NGO Forum and the Chinese Organizing Committee have not come through. Sual de Marco is from Nicaragua. She's in a wheelchair, and she's angry that disabled women have been marginalized and excluded once again.
Estamos exigiendo un derecho como mujeres.
This is a right like a women.
Iguales a ustedes.
Just like you.
Nosotras somos mujeres iguales.
We are women like you.
Sentimos, pensamos.
We feel, we think.
La diferencia es no ver, no caminar y no hablar.
The only difference is that we don't see or we don't walk or we don't talk.
Pero nosotras tenemos que estar aquí con los mismos derechos.
But we
The conference site is a nightmare for these women. Most buildings lack elevators or ramps, and workshops, even the workshops on disability rights issues, are scheduled on the second, third, and fourth floors. There are very few wheelchair-accessible buses, and the organizers refuse to provide sign language interpretation. So Florence Lusaka of Uganda has had to rely on a friend to sign and speak for her. But that friend is in a wheelchair.
Here I am. I came with no interpreter. I've lost all the money I've spent to come here because I came without an interpreter. These at the disability tent, you know, at the disabled women using chairs, they couldn't get in. My interpreter right here can't even get up this ramp. Please, please, change. Give us disabled our rights. UN, please give us our rights.
Disability rights activists say that hundreds of millions of women worldwide are disabled, and 90% of them will never be employed. Tasneem Sadiq of Bangladesh says any woman is a candidate to become disabled at some point in her life. So the women's movement must integrate disabled women and their issues into the larger agenda. Disabled girls worldwide are denied access to education, and women with disabilities, whether they live at home or in institutions, are disproportionately targets of physical and sexual abuse. Robin Foster of Boston is a trained guide for the blind. She's here helping her friend get around a site that's filled with cracked tiles, potholes, narrow passageways, and throngs of people. She says the condition of the facilities here also raises questions about disabled people in China.
Walking through the Beijing and Huairu, I have not seen one single disabled Chinese person. Not one. And I find that in one quarter of the world's population, there's got to be disabled people here. There has to be.
Since their demonstration, organizers have put more ramps on buildings and assigned volunteers to help disabled women get around the site. But as advocates of visibility, accessibility, and opportunity for the disabled, some of these women still want to know where the Chinese disabled people are. This is Julie Drizin reporting from the International Women's Conference in Huairou, China.
Special thanks to Shapu Alafante of KPFA in Berkeley, Susan Mooney of IGCS Women's Net, and Helene Rosenbluth for production help on this piece.
The women just credited are the ones who made it possible for the Pacifica Radio Network to receive daily news stories from the non-governmental forum in Huairou, in defiance of a Chinese ban on reporters there. The workaround was to visit the email demonstration facility that the Chinese had given a permit and attach audio files to emails.
You've been listening to the newscast of WINGS, the Women's International News Gathering Service. This edition was produced by Frieda Worden with Virginia Calvino, Eliza Graney, Lisa Hayes, Hope Lafferty, Mary O'Grady, Lara Saponara, Carol Stahl, and Sarah Wise. Travel support for WINGS staff attending the Fourth World Conference on Women and the NGO Forum was provided by the Foundation for a Compassionate Society. You can hear more about the Global Women's Conferences in WINGS' weekly current affairs series. Call your local station for times and days these programs will air.
Women around the world are still pursuing the goals that were raised at the UN World Conference on Women in 1995. For more about these issues and how they're being addressed, check your local community radio station for times they broadcast WINGS weekly programs. You can email wings@wings.org for more information. WINGS thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, whose events can be viewed on the website maternalgifteconomymovement.org. The WINGS sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Join CFRC on September 28th at the Broom Factory at 9:30 a.m. for our Airwave YGK Sound Tech Workshop. Rob Bailey of Kingston Soundworks will facilitate this hands-on workshop for young emerging musicians just starting out playing gigs. Come learn soundboard tech, terminology, troubleshooting, communications, equipment setup, and sound check basics with this local industry pro. Register now for the free workshop, make in-person connections with local musicians at a prestigious venue, and learn the ropes of sound mixing to help you get started with your live stage stage performances. The fun starts at 9:30 a.m. on September 28th at Broom Factory and includes a catered lunch from our friends at Old Farm Fine Foods. Register now via CFRC.ca. This CFRC Airwave YGK workshop is made possible through the support of the City of Kingston, Kingston Arts Council, the Kingston Music Office, the Broom Factory, and our friends at Kingston Soundworks.
When I say beat, you say banter. Beat.